Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio. Well, you can tell fall's coming when you find yourself contemplating turning on your oven again. Well, today we're bringing you some autumn inspiration from one of America's most talented cooks. She is Sally Schneider, author of A New Way to Cook, and she has a sensational fall menu that, believe it or not, is actually good for us. Well, wine maverick Joshua Wesson is checking out low-alcohol wines for our feast. We're off to Morocco for unforgettable dishes from its Sephardic Jews. Then it's a new kind of control in our lives at the supermarket checkout from novelist Jim Crace. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get everything rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, if you go to Sioux City, Iowa, there's a drive-in you need to know about. It's called Tasty In-N-Out. It's been there since 1955, and it's the place to go for the most delicious onion chips you'll ever find.
Onion chips? What are onion chips?
Well, now, my guess is you would think, as we did, that an onion chip is like a potato chip. Mm-hmm. But you would be wrong, because an onion chip is actually a large petal of fresh onion. I mean, I don't know if you'd call it a petal. It's maybe a 2 by 2 inch hunk of an onion that has been deep fried.
It's deep fried, and it's served with a kind of creamy white dip, sort of like a ranch dressing, and it's addictive. They serve these by the gallon there.
What a great idea. Is it in a batter, or is it, you know, like an onion ring, or is it just fried on its own?
It's kind of lightly battered.
But very lightly.
You know, I'm going to give you an analogy and then take the analogy right back because it's so much better than this. But have you ever eaten one of those, like, blooming onions?
Ew.
Those things that come as appetizers sometimes, where it's like a whole onion that it looks like a chrysanthemum and it's like opened up and deep fried. Well, it's sort of along the lines of that, but 100 times better.
Okay, but here's my perennial question. Do they have anything else?
Oh, of course they do. In fact, the onion chips are really a side dish for the specialty of the house, which is a tasty sandwich. Now, tasty is spelled T-A-S-T-E-E, like the name of the drive-in. And what a tasty sandwich is this place's version of the Northwest Iowa favorite, the loose meat sandwich.
Now you have to define.
Are you following us?
I'm following you, but you have to give me definitions. What is a loose meat sandwich?
A loose meat sandwich is ground beef on a bun. It's sort of like a fallen apart hamburger, but with extra seasoning in the meat. It's
or a sloppy joe without the slop.
Yeah, a slopless sloppy joe is a loose meat sandwich, but it holds together. That's the amazing thing about a loose meat. The meat, it's almost like the consistency of sticky rice that you get with sushi. So it really holds together in the bun, and yet it tends to fall apart as you eat it. And it's pre-seasoned. I mean, unlike a hamburger, it's got the seasoning in the meat.
Sioux City is really loose meat central. It's really one of the more unfortunately named regional specialties. It sounds like a gastrointestinal disease or something, but it's quite delicious. And when you have onion chips and ranch dressing with it, and don't they make homemade root beer there too, Michael?
If they do, I am unaware of
it. I think they do. And it's really delicious.
And it's a drive-in, so you eat in the car.
It's absolutely a drive-in. You can eat in the car, or there are a handful of picnic tables where you can take your food and eat there. But it's basically drive-through, and it's really, there's something about it. It's one of those mid-century drive-ins that has changed very little over the years.
It's run by the Callaghan family, and they've been running it since, I think, 1955, and very little has changed.
So these onion chips are their creation. Has anybody copied it, you know, like in the area? Has this become also onion chip central by any chance?
Yes, it definitely has.
You're right, you got it.
A loose meat sandwich, which is also called a tavern. That's the other name for loose meats.
Also called a Charlie Boy, also called a Maid
Right. Right, and
totally
onion chips. That's what you eat in Sioux City, Iowa.
Okay, hey guys, thanks.
All right.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern have a new updated version of their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, every week, you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert and former sommelier with a democratic streak a mile wide. He loves hunting down bargain wines, and he's just as eager to suggest the right wine for Big Mac as for Chateaubriand. Hey, Josh, welcome.
Welcome right back at you.
Josh, we get a lot of mail asking about low-alcohol wines and non-alcohol wines. Do you know anything about this stuff?
Yeah, I do. I'm not a big fan of no alcohol wines, but there are a couple of decent ones out there. And no alcohol literally means there's no alcohol in the wine. There are a number of different processes that a winemaker can apply to regular wine with good old alcohol in it to remove the alcohol. The one that's the most popular is reverse osmosis, and don't ask me what it is, but I know that it's there and it works, and it pulls alcohol out of wine that's been traditionally fermented, and you end up with wine that sometimes is a little bit hollow. It's like taking the middle out of a cake or punching a hole in a speaker and hearing the sound, but you don't hear the complete sound.
Mm-hmm.
Because alcohol adds weight, it adds sometimes a little bit of flavor. It's certainly a textural component in wine. When you pull it out, sometimes you miss it a lot. But you know, the way to avoid that, if you don't want any alcohol in wine and you want to have wine, is to find something that's going to sort of mask that missing element. And the best no alcohol wine I've ever tasted is from California. It's made by a producer named Ariel, and it's a sparkling wine. And it's made similar to a champagne, but because the bubbles are in there, you don't notice the fact that the alcohol is missing.
Hmm.
And consequently, it really is a credible alternative to both champagne and other sparkling wines. And I've fooled more than one savvy palate by giving them this Ariel sparkling wine. Still wines have a bit more difficult time because you don't have any bubbles to sort of trick the palate. But if you're going to get a non-alcohol wine, then I would go for a red over a white, because you'll have more body and more texture from the skin of the grapes adding to the taste of the red wine. And Ariel and a couple of other producers make some pretty credible Cabernet Sauvignon-based no-alcohol wines. But it's more fun to drink low-alcohol wine, because low-alcohol has some of that alcohol. You don't have the problem with that hole in the middle that you do with non-alcohol wines. And they come from pretty specific places, so they're pretty easy to find.
So what are some of the ones you like?
Well, low-alcohol wines tend to come from places where the grapes are grown in cool climates, because if the grapes don't ripen to a tremendous degree, if they don't get filled with sugar, then they can't ferment into a high-alcohol wine. Because what happens during fermentation is the sugar gets converted to alcohol. So where do you find cool climates that grow grapes? In the northern parts of countries like France, in the Loire Valley, or in Germany, up in the Mosel. And I just tasted two incredibly delicious low-alcohol wines. They're both white. One from the Loire Valley. It's a Muscadet, and it's made by a producer named Michel Bregion, Bregeon. And it's kind of expensive for a Muscadet. It's about $10, $11. But it is hand-harvested, estate-bottled, about 9, 10% alcohol. And it's just delicious. If you're having some simple seafood, cold lobster, fantastic. And if you want to go one step further and drop the alcohol down into the 7, 8% range, you go high on over to the Mosel in Germany, which is the northernmost wine producing region there, and look for Rieslings that are labeled QBA, which is the lowest level of sweetness and quality in the German hierarchy of ranking wines. But that's a good thing if you want low alcohol, because QBAs are generally around 7, 8, 9% in alcohol. And an Irsch, I-R-S-C-H, here's the tricky part, Ochfenner, O-C-K-F-E-N-E-R. I'm from New York, I'm a New Yorker, and Ochfenner comes from Ochfen, and it's a Riesling, and it sells for maybe $6, $7. I think it's a 2000 vintage that's available now, and it's just perfect, because you can't possibly get, you know, schnockered or wrecked on a glass or two of this low alcohol, off-try, delicious white wine. But look for cool climate whites. They can come from Oregon or New York State or somewhere in New Zealand. As long as the climate's cool, you're going to end up with wines that aren't terribly alcoholic. And that's the secret to low-alcohol wines.
Any low-alcohol reds that you'd recommend?
Well, red grapes generally like to grow in slightly warmer to much warmer climates than white grapes. So it's a little bit harder to find red wines that are low in alcohol. But just look in the same places that you're looking for white wines that are low in alcohol, and you'll always find a red or two stuck in there. If you go to the Loire Valley, not terribly far from Muscadet, mm-hmm. you'll find Anjou, and Anjou Rouge is always low in alcohol. It may be 10, 11%. Which is about 2 or 3% lower than your average Cabernet or Merlot. And if you look at Zinfandel bottles, they're up at 15, 16, 17%. There are yeasts now that can produce wines that are insanely alcoholic. And there are yeasts that also can make wines low in alcohol. So if you find red wines from cool climates, generally they'll be low in alcohol, and they'll probably be using some yeasts that don't ferment that sugar as wildly and aggressively as they did in the past. So that's an extra benefit to finding red wines from cool climate white wine producing regions.
Okay, because not as much sugar gets converted to alcohol.
Exactly.
Okay, hey, Josh, thank you.
Pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is the creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find his low alcohol wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, low alcohol is fine, but right now I'm in the opposite frame of mind. I need a really decent 80 proof brandy because I am going to do brandied peaches. We just found this gorgeous fruit. Now, this is the easiest way I know to preserve. As long as you keep the fruit submerged in the alcohol, it's safe to eat. You just have a sugar syrup that you flavor however you want it. You have the brandy. And, you know, I always use organic fruit, but just make sure the fruit really tastes good. Now, I'm putting the recipe up on the website. We're going to call it Lynn's Brandied Fruits, and you can get it at splendidtable.org. Okay? Coming up, a healthy and luscious fall menu to lure you back into the kitchen, the Moroccan cuisine nobody talks about, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. It's fall, and the kitchen is calling us back inside. You feel that urge to just cook for fun, or maybe to cook for the first time. It's time to cash in on all that new, voluptuous stuff that's in the market, but to cook it in a healthy way. Now, I know one person to lead us back into the kitchen. She's worked out brilliant strategies for cooking simple yet lusty food that's good for us. She is Sally Schneider, author of A New Way to Cook. Sally, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So what are you cooking right now? What's inspiring you?
Well, you know, we had a few cold days about a week ago, and I was in the market, and all of a sudden I saw everything there that I wanted, and I wanted to turn on the oven and start roasting these foods. So I've come up with this menu. The first thing that came to mind were wild mushrooms. They're everywhere. Depending where you live in the country, you'll get chanterelles or porcini, which we call bolets. The supermarkets are even full of cultivated mushrooms, which are wonderfully delicious as well. I roast them because mushrooms are very porous and they absorb a lot of fat. So I roast them to concentrate their flavors, and I put them on a rustic garlic toast. That's a slice of coarse bread, toasted, brushed with olive oil, rubbed with garlic, the mushrooms piled on, and that's my bruschetta to start off this meal with a glass of champagne.
Oh.
Now, as great. You know, I never want anything to be cut in stone. So the garlic toast can have other toppings, like the fresh dried beans that are in the market right now, cooked with a little olive oil and sage is a fabulous bruschetta.
What you're saying, though, is that instead of sautéing mushrooms, which I do all the time, the roasting uses less fat and gives you better flavor?
Exactly. I make my oven my tool. It is also the hearth. That's the hearth we have in modern times, which is the oven. And it means that I don't have to fuss with them. I'm not doing any stovetop cooking. I can leave it on for a few hours and do this entire menu, and the house is going to fill with the most incredible aromas, particularly of the garlic that is so perfect now because it's the summer's harvest that is in perfect shape. It's firm and fresh and juicy and delicious.
Mm. Okay, you mentioned a menu. What's the next course?
Next course, after we've had this bruschetta, is an herb-scented Tuscan pork roast.
Oh, brother.
I'm taking up, yes, I know. And I learned it in Tuscany from a wonderful chef. And Tuscan cooking is very simple and very potent and wonderful. A pork roast, which I'm seasoning with a Tuscan herb salt, which is garlic, sage, and rosemary chopped with kosher salt. And then I stuff some in the center of the roast. I kind of bore a hole with a wooden spoon, mm-hmm. and I rub the outside with the rest of it, and I'm going to wrap it in pancetta. The reason I wrap it in pancetta, that wonderful unsmoked, cured Italian style of bacon, mm-hmm. is because it gives back the pork the flavor that we've taken out by trying to get rid of the fat. And then it tastes like a real Italian pig.
This is interesting. So you're using a saturated fat here.
Absolutely. I heartily believe in saturated fats, but in moderation. And using them where we'll get the biggest bang for the buck. And pancetta, which is going to baste the pork and the fat is going to fall into the bottom of the pan and the pancetta will get crisp. It's amazing what a change in flavor it makes on the pork.
Good trick.
Now, again, my being rebellious and not wanting to have anything cut in stone, this Tuscan herb salt, you can vary. You could just make it rosemary, you could add savory, you could add lemon peel. Beyond the pork roast, you can rub it on chicken, on pork chops, on quail. You could sprinkle it on vegetables, which I often do when I'm lazy. I make some and let it dry out uncovered because the salt will dry the herbs, and then it's just a fabulous seasoning.
So I can keep this around.
Absolutely. It should be a staple in your kitchen. And this approach is a great approach for all kinds of meats and poultry and game, of rubbing them with a seasoned salt.
What's going to go with the Tuscan pork roast?
Well, I'm thinking about these winter squashes and pumpkins that are in the market now, which are so delicious, and we now have so many varieties. My favorite has shown up in the supermarket, which is a kabocha squash, which has a wonderful silky flesh. Now, again, I'm going to roast it because that's going to concentrate the flavor, bring out the silkiness, and that silkiness is going to allow me to use less fat in seasoning it. I'm going to roast the squash and then puree it to make a very fine winter squash puree to go with the pork roast. The juices of the pork roast can go on it and flavor it. In this case, I think I'll just season it with salt and pepper. You could also add sweet spices like cinnamon or cracked coriander. These squashes love sage and garlic. So I also use this method of roasting the squash to make other things. If I add some chicken broth and sautéed onions, it becomes a fabulous, silky squash soup. Then I will drizzle in some olive oil or a sage-flavored olive oil with some shavings of Parmesan cheese.
Oh.
I'll also make this for a bruschetta. I'll use my garlic toasts, use the puree on the bruschetta, and again drizzle a sage-flavored oil and top it with fried sage leaves.
That's very good. But it's
Are
interesting.
You kidding me?
You're doing this whole thing in the oven. I mean, the entire meal.
Absolutely. These are recipes that only take a few steps. Each part just takes a few steps, and you put it in the oven, and you go on to the next thing. So you're not belaboring anything.
What's for dessert?
One of my favorites. We have apples, pears, figs, and so on in the market now. I personally love apple tart, so I'm going to make a rustic rosemary apple tart. Now, I'm kind of a lazy girl, so I will make a flaky butter pastry, which is easy. I can make it in the food processor. I'll roll it out into a free-form round. I'll cut up my apples, toss them with sugar, maybe some vanilla bean, lemon, and some chopped rosemary, and I'll pile them into the center of this free-form round. And then I just fold up the edges, and that's it. And I bake the tart like that. So you have the edges get very crisp. It's enfolded in pastry, but without having to work it into a tin.
This sounds sensational. The oven's back in action. It's a great menu. Hey, Sally, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. It's a book I keep going back to again and again. Well, you can get her entire autumn menu, the wild mushroom bruschetta, the herbed Tuscan pork roast, the silken roasted squash, and that rustic rosemary apple tart, all on the website, splendidtable.org. Trends come and go, sometimes so fast that you barely raise your fork and the trend is over. Well, the newest is Moroccan cuisine, and we've got an unexpected take on it. Food writer and cooking teacher Kitty Morse has co-authored a cookbook that is more of a memoir of a people and their vanishing way of life than solely a collection of recipes. The people are the Sephardic Jews of Morocco, especially from the city of Fez. The book is called The Scent of Orange Blossoms, Sephardic Cuisine in Morocco. Kitty Morse, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, Kitty, who taught you this food? Who taught you to cook?
Most of my recipes were taught to me by my great aunt Tita, my maternal grandfather's sister. She was absolutely passionate about cooking, and I can't remember one single occasion visiting Tita where we didn't spend time in the kitchen. So when I got serious about writing down recipes that I felt were disappearing in the culture in Morocco, I would follow Tita around the kitchen, whether she was in Rabat or Casablanca, and try and jot down what she was making. And of course, in true form, and this is a very typical North African manner, you just kind of say a little bit of this and a little bit of that and, you know, a dash of this. And I had to quantify what she was writing down. It was really great fun and a challenge. And so that's how I learned how to make les petites salades, small salads, which open up a Sephardic meal.
What are these salads about? Can you describe them for us?
There are some very specific Sephardic salads unique to the Moroccan Jews. For example, one of Tita's favorites was a frita. A frita is a blend of roasted peppers and tomatoes which are cooked until they attain almost a jam-like consistency. You flavor them just with a touch of garlic and salt, and it is so good, and it is so traditional. That's one of them. Another one is a salad of fresh tomatoes with preserved lemons being a unique Moroccan condiment. So these really, it's like a little bit like Proust and his Madeleine, you know, for a Sephardic Jew or from Morocco, abroad, always remembers a frita.
Instead of the Madeleines from Proust.
Instead of the Madeleines from Proust, yes.
Is there a characteristic flavor or style that typifies what Sephardic Moroccan food actually is?
What characterizes the Sephardic cuisine of Morocco is a blend of spices that combines Arab flavors with Sephardic flavors. And one of the main dishes, the Shabbat stew, for example, the dafina, it's called. Dafina, which is derived actually from the Arabic word medfun, which means hidden, also has another name, srina, derived from the Arabic word for schoon, which means hot. So you see how the Arab culture permeates the cuisine.
Yeah.
It was prepared on Fridays around 2 p.m., and it's beef shank and wheat berries and potatoes, eggs in their shell, all sorts of specific ingredients flavored with them, allspice, nutmeg, and or a touch of mace sometimes, and then put in a very heavy Dutch oven, traditionally taken to the public oven to be hidden in the coals and to cook overnight until the next day, served on Saturday after the men return from the synagogue. And that is a very traditional Jewish or Moroccan Sephardic dish.
Kitty, what about hospitality traditions? Because every country has their own.
Well, one of the essential elements of the hospitality in a Moroccan home or a Sephardic home would be to be served a glass of mint tea, which is a traditional national drink of Morocco, and aniseed biscuits, especially in Sephardic homes. It's a wonderful little cracker, which is half midway between savory and sweet and flavored with aniseed. And it's just very, very traditional. Actually, I love these biscuits dunked in a glass of mint tea. There isn't a Sephardic home in Morocco that would not have a good supply of those aniseed biscuits.
You were telling me about candied grapefruit rind and that there was a ritual that went along with it in your family.
Well, that too is that comes straight from my great grandmother, and it's very easy to make. It's grapefruit and sugar. Follow the recipe, and you get my great grandmother's candy grapefruits. And what it is, it's a sweet that you serve at the end of a meal, even after dessert. You put it usually served in quarters, and you just set a dish of these candied grapefruits in the middle of the table, and everyone with a little knife and fork cuts off a little piece to savor at will. And again, like the aniseed biscuits that we were talking about beforehand, at the end of a meal in a Moroccan Sephardic home, you do get a glass of mint tea. The glass of mint tea, of course, is the national beverage of Morocco. So when you have these little mignardises, what the French call mignardises at the end of the meal, a little sweet to end all sweets, you just savor that, you know, slowly with a glass of mint tea. And it's just wonderful. It's a great gift, actually. I often make those to give away. They've got a beautiful amber color. They're just yum. I recommend them.
Kitty Morse, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Kitty Morse is co-author with her friend Danielle Mamen of The Scent of Orange Blossoms, Sephardic Cuisine from Morocco. Now, Kitty's left us with those two hospitable recipes, the candied grapefruit peel and the aniseed biscuits. We are really daring you not to cook this week. Anyway, you can find them on the website, splendidtable.org. Other people's attempts at controlling our lives are sometimes subtle. They can be right under our noses and we never notice. In his collection of short stories, The Devil's Larder, novelist Jim Crace looks at the weekly trip to the supermarket.
A youngish man, a trifle overweight, too anxious for his age, completed his circuit of the supermarket shelves and cabinets and stood in line, ashamed as usual. He arranged his purchases on the checkout belt and waited, with his eyes fixed on the street beyond the shop window, while the woman at the till scanned all the barcodes on his medicines, his vitamins, his air freshener, his toilet tissue, his frozen meals for one, his tins, his magazines, his beer and his deodorant, his bread, bananas, milk, his fat-free yogurt, his jar of decaf, and his treats. Today, some roasted chicken legs, some grapes, a block of chocolate, and two croissants. He rubbed his thumb along the numbers embossed on his credit card, while each item triggered a trill of recognition from the till. The till's computer recognized the young man's distinctive shopping fingerprint as well, the usual ratio of fat to starch, the familiar selection of canned food, the recent and increasing range of health supplements, the unique combination of monthly magazines. The pattern of the shopping identified the customer. Even before the woman at the till had swiped the credit card, the computer had lined up the young man's details. His list of purchases for the previous 7 months, his credit rating, his customer loyalty score. It knew broadly who he was and how he lived. It could deduce what his modest rooms above the travel shop were like, how stale they were, how flowerless, how functional, how crying out for change. Here was the man whose cat had died or run away 3 months ago, no cat food purchased since that time. Here was the customer who had not left the neighborhood for more than 7 days in living, bite-sized memory. Last spring, he tried and failed to cut down on patisseries and sugar. Today, for once, he had resisted his usual impulse purchase of a packet of cheroots. Computer screened a message on the woman's till. Remind the customer he has not purchased cereals or cheese or vegetables this month. Remind him of our special offers. 12 cans of lager for the price of 10. Buy one bottle of our Boulevard liqueur and get a second free. Remind him that time is passing more quickly than he thinks. His washing powder should be used by now, as should the contraceptives that he bought 2 years ago. He must need basics such as rice and pasta, soap, toothpaste, flour, oil and condiments. Inform him of our retail schemes, and that we open now on Sunday afternoons. Advise him that he ought to do more cooking for himself. He ought to tidy up and clean the bathroom tiles with our new lemon whitener. He ought to start afresh. Suggest to him he tours our shelves again at once. For what we choose is what we are. He should not miss this second opportunity to recreate himself with food.
You better watch your step.
Jim Crace is author of The Devil's Larder. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this is a tough one. What ingredient flavored chocolate and was essential to perfume? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. That number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. And it was a challenge. The question was, what ingredient flavored chocolate and was essential to perfume? The answer is ambergris. Now, it comes from the intestine of the sperm whale. In 1632, an Italian duke's cook called for it, along with jasmine flowers, to flavor his chocolate drink. Now, ancient peoples from China to Greece treasured ambergris. It pops up in Renaissance recipes, but nobody describes what it tastes like. Recently, though, I read that it smells sort of pleasantly earthy when it's heated. Now, early on, people figured out that ambergris fixed the scent of perfumes. So for that reason and several others, the sperm whale became a prime target. Now, part of the tragedy of the slaughter of the sperm whales was the fact that not all of them have ambergris. This is how it works. When the whale has eaten too many giant squid, which, by the way, is a favorite food, the undigestible squid beaks start to irritate the whale's intestine, so this fatty substance that's called ambergris is produced to soothe the irritation. Well, luckily, perfumes now use synthetic ambergris, and the sperm whale is no longer hunted. But the next time you take a cup of hot chocolate, remember that Italian cook back in 1632? Ambergris may not be appealing, but those jasmine flowers? That's not really a bad idea. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We've got Rick on the line. So, Rick, what is on your mind? What do you want to discuss?
Pears.
All right.
Yeah, pears. My family and I moved into a house about 5 years ago, and we inherited a couple of really prolific pear trees. But you know, we haven't done anything with them. They fall, deers eat them. So we're trying to develop a plan this year, a plan for these pears. And so I'm wondering if you have ideas and opinions about the various pros and cons beyond sort of our list is eating, which there's a limit to, obviously, baking, canning, preserves, drying,
right,
and maybe something with French toast. But
Yeah. Oh, pears sautéed and served with French toast could be great.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You could take, first of all, do the pears taste good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the premise. Otherwise,
like pears, right.
Yeah, otherwise, don't even bother with them. One of the things is peel them, cut them into wedges, sear them in hot butter,
mm-hmm.
and that can accompany, think about all the meats and even the seafood. Do you know how good grilled salmon is with sautéed pear?
Never thought of it.
It's fabulous. Anything that has a rich taste, any fish that has a rich taste, scallops would be wonderful with pear.
That's great.
You follow where I'm going?
Yeah, I do. And we live in Maine, so lots of seafood available.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. You've got those great little tiny baby shrimp, don't you? Those little ones.
Yeah, they're smaller than the like the Gulf.
And they're very sweet. Yeah. Now that would be great. Dice pears. They're still a little firm ripe. Dice the pears, sprinkle them with lemon or lime juice, toss them with a teeny bit of sour cream and a little bit of mayonnaise and some green scallions and then a big handful of those baby pink shrimp.
Mm.
And it's a great salad. Pear chutney. You know, check out some good books on preserves because when you have things like, you know, again, you want firm ripe pear for this. And you do them with things like onion and lots of garlic, and you would have maybe sweet red pepper, and you do them in vinegar and sugar with spices.
Hey, great idea.
Yeah, you cook that, and you can that. You know, follow the directions so it's safe.
All right.
The other nice thing you can do with them is do a real, real, real slow oven bake on them.
Mm-hmm.
and they get caramelly. Again, cut them up in wedges. And if the skin isn't tough or doesn't taste bad, leave the skin on. Spread them in a real shallow baking pan. Sprinkle them with brown sugar. Dot them with a little butter. And a sprinkling of, believe it or not, a little black pepper.
Really?
Yeah, it's a great accent with pears.
Great.
And put it in an oven that's about 200 degrees.
Slow bake, just
real slow, and every once in a while stir them, but leave them until they're shrunken and really caramelly, and then that you could freeze, and that you could you could eat it on its own. It's wonderful over ice cream. You can put it as a filling into cakes or cupcakes. You can put it with gingerbread in the middle of winter. You know, just think homemade hot gingerbread with some of this wonderful kind of baked caramelly pear on the side. You could sprinkle it with balsamic vinegar and then top a salad with it as a first course. You see?
I see.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yeah. So I think embarrassment of riches of ideas here.
You got a lot of stuff you can do with them. And I mean, it's a treasure. And you got them in your backyard. Everybody dreams of, you know, their own stuff like that. That's the goal.
That's great. Yeah, it's just been wasting. So thanks a lot.
Hey, you are welcome. And enjoy. Get everybody in on this. It's a family operation.
Will do.
Thanks, Rick.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
I just got my hands on a new book, and this is really intriguing. If you like to preserve, but you're kind of bored with the recipes out there, this book is called Mes Confitures. That's M-E-S. It's French for my jams. It's by a French woman named Christine Ferber, and it's been translated into English. It's just out. And she evidently does these fabulous small batch preserves. She's a fiend about getting the true taste of the fruit. The recipes look wonderful. I've not tried these, but let me just read you a couple of names. White peach preserve with rose de chine tea. That's hibiscus tea. Or green tomato, apple, and orange jam. And there's a ton of these. They're very simple. And she's got this neat trick where she has you take whatever you're preserving, mix it with sugar and lemon, bring it to a simmer, immediately take it off the stove, put it in a non-reactive, you know, like a glass bowl, put some parchment over it and refrigerate it overnight. And what happens is the sugar gets slowly absorbed into the fruit, and it's a much more delicate, true fruit flavor. And then you finish off by cooking the juice that you drain off and then throwing the fruit in at the last moment. So you get this real lively fruit flavor. It's called Mes Confitures, and it's by Christine Ferber. Take a look at it. See what you think. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Lee calling. So, Lee, what's up?
Lynn, I've become an addict listening to your program. I thoroughly enjoy it.
I love to hear this.
My question today concerns braising. I had an article from the New York Times, which I lost. I love braised lamb shanks, but what is braising, and what other things could I braise?
Ah, okay. Well, braising is, Lee, it's a basic technique, and you've asked a great question, because a lot of people follow a recipe, but they don't think what the recipe is really telling them. And I always believe if you understand how one technique works, you can then start to do it with a lot of different foods.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what braising is you brown the food. And it's usually something that needs to be cooked. You know, in other words, you wouldn't do this with a tender steak. You need something that needs to be cooked to be tenderized.
I see. Mm-hmm.
You brown the food in some kind of fat, and then you add some kind of moisture to it, not necessarily covering it and having it swimming in it, because when you do that, you're stewing, but enough moisture. It may be in the form of something like canned tomatoes, or it may be the obvious thing, broth or wine.
I see. When you say brown the food in liquid?
No, brown the food in fat, and then cook it with a modest amount of liquid slowly to tenderize it.
I see.
That's the technique.
Could I brown it in olive oil?
Absolutely. You could brown it in olive oil. You could brown it in canola oil. You could brown in butter. You could brown in some form of pork fat. I mean, olive oil is, I like to brown in something that brings flavor. And olive oil is the healthy oil. It has a lot of flavor.
I wondered if you could do fish.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, the thing with fish is it cooks quickly. So what you want to do is you brown it kind of fast. So you get, let's say, let's take a skillet. Usually do this in a shallow pan. So you're going to have a skillet, okay?
Yes.
Film the bottom of it with olive oil. You don't have to use a lot, but just enough to coat the bottom. All right?
All right.
Put your fish in. And you want a fish that's a fairly thick cut fish because that'll cook more, you know, it'll take a little more time to cook. So it can be fillets. It could be chunks of fish. And I'd throw in some chopped up onion as well.
Oh.
Okay. Get the oil pretty hot. Set the heat to medium high. Wait a few moments and then stand back as you just kind of gently slip in the fish and the onion. And use a spatula to keep turning them until they get really brown. But you're keeping the heat up around medium high. And you want to get them seared on all sides. Then you can throw in a couple of chopped cloves of garlic. And maybe a cup or so of cut up tomatoes. And a little bit of fresh basil. And a few olives if you want.
I'm getting hungry.
But you can vary. You can vary these ingredients. But I'm just giving you a basic Mediterranean kind of feeling. And then the idea is that you would turn the heat down a little bit. Stir things together gently. Cover it. Cook it for 10, 15 minutes or until the fish seems to be done all the way to the center. And the way I tell that is I cut into the thing. And I look. And if it's sort of opaque to center, it's done. You're finished. And that's a fast braise for fish. If we were doing it with, let's say, cut up chicken, we would let it cook for 30 or 40 minutes, but the basic idea is still the same.
Yes.
Quick a browning and then adding some kind of moisture to it and then letting it cook and all that.
Why would you use braising over another technique?
It's when you don't, when something is something that doesn't require long cooking.
I see.
So it's like something that's a really tough cut of meat where you really want to cook it for a long time. You could still braise it. You could braise it, but usually people add more liquid, and when you almost cover something with liquid, then you're stewing it.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you wouldn't braise a really tender piece of meat or food because that usually is ending up being overcooked.
Well, I think that explains it.
Okay, Lee. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Kate, who has been waiting patiently. Kate, what's up?
Hi. I was curious, what would be a good thing to do with sardines? I happen to really like sardines, or at least I did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I haven't bought them as an adult, and I just remember really liking them.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if there's a better way to buy them, like either fresh or if there's a better canned variety to buy. But I'm kind of interested in doing something interesting with them.
Well, were the canned ones the ones that you really liked as a kid?
I remember having sardine sandwiches and really liking them.
You know,
weird.
I think sardines fall into that category of either you love them or you hate them.
Yeah.
And I have never been a fan of canned sardines, but there's a world of people who are.
Yeah.
But a fresh sardine... Oh, they are so good.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, with the canned sardines, a pal of mine does something with them that I think is really great. She takes the canned sardines. She strips away the flesh, you know, and she takes them and she mashes them.
Uh-huh.
And she adds chopped onion and sour cream and a little mayonnaise and uses it as a spread.
Wow.
On things like, you know, raw cucumber and raw vegetables.
Oh, good.
It is really great. You put that on a slice of tomato, and it's dynamite. But the thing I like are fresh sardines. If you can get pristinely fresh ones, there's an old preservation trick from Italy that just makes for great summer eating. You take the sardines, and you dip them in flour and salt and pepper,
uh-huh.
and you pan fry them in olive oil. And you set them aside, okay? And then you film olive oil in the bottom of a big pan. You put in a ton of thin sliced red onions. I mean, like 2 or 3 pounds. Over the highest heat you can, okay?
Uh-huh.
With some sliced garlic and salt and pepper. And you just toss them around for like 30 seconds max. And then you add a cup and a half, 2 cups of vinegar. Now, this is for maybe a mess of sardines, like a pound and a half of sardines.
Okay.
And you boil down that vinegar until it's about half gone.
Uh-huh.
And it's not super duper acid. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And you pour that over the sardines and then you serve them. You can let them sit at room temperature because the vinegar kind of starts to permeate for about 30 or 40 minutes and you serve them like that.
Wow.
And you serve that with a big coarse chunk of crusty bread and some sliced tomatoes. It's glorious.
Making it tonight.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, it's dynamite, and it's a very old way of preserving the sardines and other fish, and you find it used, that technique used with all kinds of different fish all over northern Italy.
Okay.
You used to pay taxes with it. They used to stuff trout in barrels up in northern Tuscany and ship it to Florence to pay taxes.
I could take that.
Yeah, it's preserved in vinegar and onions and a little garlic. What could be bad? Hey, enjoy.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we've got Kirk on the line. Kirk, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I have a question for you about making a sauerkraut dessert.
Oh, we don't get a lot of questions about sauerkraut dessert.
I imagine not. Sometime around the end of this month or early next month, I'm planning to have a bunch of my guy friends over, and we're going to do an entire sauerkraut feast. And we're just going to sit around and drink beer and watch football and eat lots of sauerkraut.
This
I can
very
make a main dish
thing.
And an appetizer, but I have no idea what to do for dessert.
Okay. You wouldn't be from Oregon by any chance, would you?
I would not.
Oh, no. Okay, because there was a point where we got a whole bunch of calls about sauerkraut from people in Oregon, and we just thought maybe there was a cult going on. A sauerkraut. You know what this reminds me of? I can't think of an immediate source, but I just got a message in my ear from my producer. We have a sauerkraut chocolate cake on the website.
Really?
So much from my memory. Yes. And you know where those recipes often come from? They come from the Depression or from the war, World War II.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So go to splendidtable.org and your problem is solved.
So this is a sweet cake or is it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. We've actually gone to the site. It's German chocolate sauerkraut fudge cake. That's the actual name of the recipe.
What a great name.
Isn't that a great name? Who could resist this?
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome, and thank you, because now I remember what's on the website. Hey, Kirk, have a good one.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Andrew Payne. He said, mashed potato is the Gentiles' chicken noodle soup. It's nature's tranquilizer. I take it instead of Valium. Now, all the information you will ever need is on our website, splendidtable.org. And believe me, if it's not there, I don't think you have to worry about it. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, take a look at the Splendid Table store. All the proceeds go to support the show. And there's something new up on the website as well. It's our new web program, and it's called Tuesday Night Kitchen. Now, you can only hear it on the web. This week, we're talking about some really new ideas of things to do with grilled vegetables. It goes up on Tuesday, so have a listen. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.